Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Teresa Gadu about her new book, Selling Anti-Slavery, Abolition and Mass Media in Antebellum America. Welcome to the podcast, Teresa.
Thank you so much, Christina.
I'm really glad that you're here. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure thing. I teach at Vanderbilt University in the English and American Studies programs, where I specialize in 19th century literature and culture. I grew up in New England, but have spent most of my life, or my adulthood at least, in the South. And at first, it seemed really strange to be writing a book on anti-slavery from my location in Middle Tennessee. But the more I researched, I realized that actually East Tennessee took the early lead in establishing anti-slavery societies and newspapers. One of the earliest anti-slavery papers, for example, was published in Jonesboro, Tennessee in 1820. So I began to, as I learned local history, kind of be reminded of how complex the geographical terrain is in terms of when we invoke terms like anti or pro-slavery. And it really prompted me at the beginning of the project to really see the anti-slavery movement less as a monolith and more as a movement with a lot of local variants. So even though I still think of myself as in many ways as a New Englander, it was very interesting to write this book from the perspective of the South, or at least my own location in the South.
So this is a really fascinating book, and it's got a lot of complexity to it. So before we get into the interview, could you give us your elevator pitch of what this book is, your brief synopsis?
Sure. I always say to my graduate students, you don't really know what your project's about until you can sum it up in one sentence to your neighbor, who's, you know, not a specialist in the field. And I guess I would say, in a nutshell, it's a book about anti-slavery media and how that media created cultural and social change.
And so that leads to my next question, which is, what inspired you to write this?
Sure. I often think about how I get from one project to another. And since this is a second book, I think mostly about the through line that came out of my first book. So my first book was about the American Gothic. And in that book, I argued that it was a genre that was haunted by history, especially the histories of race and slavery. And I wanted to continue with my second book, thinking about those histories of race and slavery. And I thought about it, you know, there were a lot of different ways in which I was thinking about how to sort of write a second book. But I kind of settled on pretty quickly thinking about the anti-slavery movement and the broad swath of media that it produced, and wanting to know more about that particular movement as a way to get into the larger kind of questions about race and slavery in my period. I was also really interested in writing a more interdisciplinary book. So my first book is really focused on the literature of the American Gothic. And while it was engaged with a historical context, mostly I used secondary sources to kind of create the context for my literary readings. And I really wanted to do more primary historical research. Not that I'll ever be a historian per se, but more interdisciplinary and bringing my literary methodology together with a more historical methodology. And in part, that grew out of my interest in print culture studies and history of the book, which was a methodology I wasn't able to really use in the first book. So I really wanted to kind of center the second book around those interests as well. And so between trying to kind of continue the through line of the thematic interest in race and slavery from the first book, but kind of challenge myself with a more ambitious methodological agenda, I came up with this more interdisciplinary primary historical kind of mode in the second book. And I guess I would also say the book is really kind of formed around this larger question, which continues to be something I think all literary people often think about, which is how culture can help to create social change. And I thought the anti-slavery movement was a really wonderful case study to explore that question through. So I think of my focus on anti-slavery as more thinking of it as a cultural project rather than a political project. And maybe that still differentiates me from the historians who often look at it, you know, in terms of its, you know, political role. I'm really thinking of the anti-slavery movement and the kind of cultural role that it played during the antebellum period.
And the book makes the case for the anti-slavery movement's centrality to 19th century media history. And to get at that media history, you had to go into the archives, and the back matter lists so many archives that you went to. How many years did this project take?
More than I would like to say. Let's just say a long time. And I was doing it, you know, simultaneously, you know, with having young children. So that also became, you know, a slowing down process. So, you know, I would go to archives and as I could. And also when I started the project, digital archives were not as robust as they currently are. So, you know, now when I think about if I had started the project today rather than, say, a decade ago, I would have probably just gone right into the digital archives and started working from them. And I really wonder what the project would have looked like or how it would have been different because of that. Having started in the actual physical archives and kind of working myself out inductively from those archives, I think shaped what I found, shaped the argument in ways that I don't think if I had just gone into the digital archives, it would have been the same. So I often give this project to my graduate students in my print culture classes. I will ask them to look at something in a very physical, material way in an archive, and then also ask them to do something similar in a digital archive and to compare and contrast what they got from each archive. And while there are many pluses to the digital archive, and I don't think I could have you know, checked all my sources in as an efficient way if I didn't have access to digital archives at the, you know, in the final stages of the book, I think I would have missed a lot if I hadn't started in the physical archive. I mean, one example is I was at the Boston Public Library doing some research, and they were having, you know, just a small exhibit out in the kind of ante room into the archive, into the reading room. And it is in, you know, behind glass in that particular exhibit. Again, not really for public display. It would only be if you were going into the reading room that you would even see this exhibit. The coin box that is on the cover of the book and also kind of forms the example of my introduction, this anti-slavery coin box that has a picture of the kneeling slave on the front, in which was used as a kind of fundraising means that people would put money into the coin box each week before it was collected. As soon as I saw that coin box, I knew that that was going to be crucial to my book. And that really kind of in many ways summed up what I was after in my book. But if I hadn't have actually been in the archive and seen it, I wouldn't have known to look for it. You know, it's not like I would have looked up in the catalog anti-slavery coin box. There are lots of examples like that in the research that I did. Another favorite example that I have is of an anti-slavery window blind. And this was just like a hand-painted window blind for a New York City parlor that an artist did in the 1830s and kind of sold. And the only way I even came across that was by going page by page through the anti-slavery newspaper, The Emancipator, and my eye just falling upon this advertisement for an anti-slavery window blind. If I were going into the digital version of that newspaper and searching anti-slavery window blind, perhaps it would have come up. But again, I wouldn't have known to search for that. I wouldn't have known that that was something that was being produced. So while part of me, you know, bemoans, you know, how long it took to go through the physical archives that I went to, I also try to, you know, remind myself that so much of what I found, I probably wouldn't have been able to find otherwise. So in terms of the archives I went to, I was trying to train myself as a historian. I was a literary critic. I really didn't know how to do history. So that was also part of the process of writing this book, is teaching myself how to do this type of methodology. So I just started the first archive I went to was the Boston Athenaeum, which I thought would be a small enough archive that I could sit and read through everything and get a sense of the whole just from this small sampling. And the librarians there were really wonderful. They, I think, got tired of me asking for them to bring me things and just finally let me sit in their vault for a few weeks and just read through everything that was there. And that just gave me a nice snapshot overview of the kinds of things I might find, the kinds of things the anti-slavery movement was producing. And from there, I then kind of went city to city. I had a wonderful fellowship at the Library Company in Philadelphia, which was also really instrumental, not only to being able to get a really great sense of the breadth of what the anti-slavery movement produced, but also have access to really wonderful librarians and archivists who could help guide me through those collections. And so when I was in Philadelphia, I did not only the Library Company, but also went to Swarthmore, who's got a great library, you know, that the Quakers produced, as well as the Pennsylvania Historical Society. And then I went back to Boston a lot of times, to the Boston Public Library, the Massachusetts Historical Society, the American Antiquarian Society, as well as to New York. And also spent some time in the Midwest archives. Oberlin has a wonderful anti-slavery archive. Because I wanted to see if I would find things that were different in, say, what would then have been in the 19th century, the more Western archives. I can't say that I did find a lot that was different per se between what I looked at in New England versus what I looked at, you know, in the Midwest. But in every archive, you would find different editions or different copies. And some copies, for example, I'm thinking here of the American Anti-Slavery Almanac, which was just a small pamphlet. And sometimes it would have a cover. And sometimes it wouldn't, and it just depended upon what that edition was that you would find in the archive. And the covers tended to have a lot of really useful information, not only in terms of the pamphlet itself and how much it cost and how, where and how well it circulated, but also a lot of advertisements for other texts too. So it was a lot of just trying to sift through and sort through a lot of material and, you know, kind of gather as much as I could to get, you know, a really expansive view of what they were producing. And then after that, kind of going back via microfilm or then later on through digital archives and trying to kind of sift out what I wanted to kind of write on, what items and objects I wanted to put together with each other and how to start to make sense of it. So it's the two-stage process, the finding of the materials and then trying to make sense of it and then weave it together into a larger argument.
And to figure out where all of these artifacts that you found really came from, why were there so many? How are they all being produced? You really studied the American Anti-Slavery Society's business model, if you will. How they earned money, how they recruited members, how they went out into the community. And your findings about that are really fascinating. Can you share with listeners how the American Antiquarian Society did these things to raise the money that was used to create all of these artifacts that you found, which were things that members of the society were purchasing?
Right. So what really, I think, set anti-slavery apart was the way in which it organized itself. So it was really a media enterprise, and it was organized like a corporation. Now, corporations didn't emerge until later in the 19th century, but it was a business enterprise that was formed in the ways in which we imagine a kind of modern corporation. There was a kind of federal or federated structure with an executive committee located in New York City that itself, the members of the executive committee had their own kind of particular things that they would do. One would be the editor, one would be the secretary. And then the managerial hierarchy would then extend out to the state societies and then the local societies. I almost think of it as a kind of franchise model that we have today, where, you know, each local society would be independent on its own, but it would be kind of branded and also guided by the national society that was headquartered in New York City. And many of the members of the executive board in New York City were themselves businessmen. So they had this, I think, very well-organized structure that they could then use to not only produce media, but then distribute it out to their auxiliaries and then bringing money from the auxiliaries back into the central system. And it was modeled on, it's important to say they didn't come up with this on their own. It was modeled on the evangelical movement, who also had a very similar kind of quasi-corporate model. And many of the members or the leaders of the anti-slavery movement in the 1830s had come out of the evangelical movement. And so they were able to kind of appropriate and adopt many of the methods that they had learned in that movement.
And you touched a few moments ago on this amazing box that is the front cover of your book. The image of it's on the front cover of your book. And then in the book, you provide this brilliant analysis of why this box was such an important marketing tool and was so crucial to their fundraising. Can you talk about that for the listeners?
Sure. So this coin box that's on my front cover was produced by the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society for their plan, which was called the Weekly Contribution Plan. So basically, there was always some sort of fundraising plan in place with the American Anti-Slavery Society. They understood they had to raise money to support their lectures and produce the media. So this box was meant to be put on your, you know, parlor mantle, meant to kind of be out in your main room to remind yourself to give money to the Anti-Slavery Society, but also to remind yourself what you were working for. So it was both a treasury, you know, something to collect money, and, you know, the organization would come by once a week and pick up your money, and you were supposed to put your money in on Sundays. So, you know, kind of tie to the kind of giving, you know, church giving as well. But it was also this kind of domestic material object, which, you know, tied into your larger parlor objects. And then also it has both an image of the kneeling slave on the front, as well as a poem and some scripture. So it sort of served as a tract, already converting yourself and any member or friend who would come to your parlor as well, with words and images to kind of adopt the cause. And then finally on the back, it gives sort of the steps by steps of how to organize yourself through this plan. So it was also kind of an organizational tool. So I love the ways in which it sort of, in a nutshell, kind of hits at all the different ways in which the organization was both trying to use these objects to further organize itself, as well as to convert newcomers, as well as to kind of reinforce those that were already converted, and then feed that all back into producing money that could produce more types of objects like this that could then further convert others. So it's a wonderful circuit.
And you talk in the book about the brilliance of it being a box you can just put pennies in, because it creates a sustainable model rather than soliciting large donations that maybe people can't keep up with. There's kind of this cultural sense that, of course, you can at least put a few pennies in and you can continue to do that, and that this created this sustained revenue. And then they had actual people who would go out and regularly collect the money from the boxes. They would sort of empty out the box and hand it back to the person. Do you know, were these women who were deployed to go collect the money?
Yes, there's another plan that was kind of came out of this plan. This was called the Weekly Contribution Plan. And then the National Society picked that up and created what they called Cent a Week Plan, which was an even cheaper plan that really just said you're just supposed to give a cent a week, whereas the Weekly Contribution Plan, you know, suggested that you could give more than that. And with the Cent a Week Plan, it was definitely women organizers who would not only, they had a little collector's card that they would write down each person's name and go around each week and put a little dot on, under that month, four dots to a month, to mark whether you had given your cent. So they not only were the kind of labor force of the organization, but they also, besides collecting money, would also then circulate tracts. So both of these plans, the Weekly Contribution Plan and the Cent a Week Plan, had tracts that went with them. So that when you gave the money, you would get a tract back. And that tract would be, in some sense, a material manifestation of what that money was meant to produce. And that tract would further convert the person in the household and tell that person how to convert others. And sometimes it wasn't just the tract that went with the plan, but you could circulate if you had finished reading something already in your house and you wanted to kind of pass it along. The the collector was also sort of a lending library who helped to circulate tracts amongst the population, and not just one-to-one, as it were. So it's a fascinating way to both raise money, reinforce what that money is standing in for, and also further circulate the tracts that money is producing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And in the book, you talk about the American Anti-Slavery Society, and you call it a media powerhouse that manufactured abolition as a compelling brand. And you also refer to it as a propaganda machine. And the propaganda being these tracts and almanacs and reading material and literature that they were creating to educate the North about slavery. And one of the things that they made for many years was the almanac. And you talk about how almanacs were already a part of the culture. So people were familiar with what an almanac was and did for people. But they created an anti-slavery version of that. And you saw many of them in the archives. Can you tell listeners about this specific kind of almanac that was created by this society?
Sure. So a lot of what the anti-slavery movement was brilliant at doing was picking up genres that were already popular and adapting them to their own message. So the almanac next to the Bible was the most important text in the 19th century. It was the most read text as well. And like the Bible, was in every household and consulted daily. So you can't really imagine a better vehicle to then propagate the anti-slavery ideas through. Something that's already in the household, a form people already know and are very familiar with, and one that they can just shift towards their own sentiments or ideas. The almanac was also a great way for them to produce the facts of slavery. So again, in the 1830s, when all of this really started, Northerners didn't know a lot about slavery. Slavery was this distant thing that they heard bits and pieces about. So one of the first things the anti-slavery movement had to do was to kind of create almost a list of facts that, you know, said what slavery was. And in doing that, transformed slavery into a social problem that needed to be solved. And so they produced a lot of data in order to achieve that. And the almanac, as an informational genre, was very data-driven. And so it was a great place for the anti-slavery movement to put its facts into as well. And then finally, the almanac was cheap print. And so it was easy to produce a lot of them relatively cheaply and circulate them widely. And then also it was a renewing print. So every year there was a new almanac. So it was a genre that allowed the anti-slavery movement to not only solidify the facts of slavery, but also to circulate them broadly and widely into, you know, everyday working households, and not just some elite space.
And the almanacs often contained calendars, if you will. They had the days for each month. There'd be a page for each month of the year, and the almanacs would have an illustration, much like a calendar today has an illustration for each month. But these almanacs that were created by the American Anti-Slavery Society had very specific types of illustrations that they used each month. And you have over 75 illustrations in this book, many of which are taken from those almanacs. Can you give listeners a sense of how the images that were included in the almanacs were important to go along with the factual presentation so that they could give people a visual of what was happening and also work on sympathy?
Yes. So it's important to remember that the rise of the image really happened in the 1830s as well. While print culture is really, I think, the center of the media production of anti-slavery, they were very much interested in what the image could do for their argument as well. So they produce many images and were interested in appealing to the eye as well as the head. And the almanac really brings these two modes together in an attempt to both appeal to the head through these facts and to the eye, and through the eye to the heart, by also including images. Often, you know, just woodblock images, not anything super refined, but with each month of the calendar having an image plus, you know, a list of facts. And often those facts and the image would work together to simultaneously reinforce each other, that it allowed for this kind of not only reinforcing each other, but also this kind of multi-way into the argument, as it were. And I think that really sets the anti-slavery movement and their almanacs apart, was their use of the visual as well as their use of trying to make each page be coherent in and of itself, that they were always trying to corroborate and coordinate things, because that's how you produce fact, right? You repeat the same thing over and over again. It all adds up to one single point in anti-slavery's case, that slavery is cruel. And whether you're telling that through statistics or you're telling that through showing an enslaved person being whipped by an enslaver, those two things all say the same thing. And that's what they were so wonderful at, which is sort of both using these kind of multimodal strategies, but then making sure these multimodal strategies always kind of integrated together and cohere together to sort of sing the same song, as it were.
When I was looking at these images and illustrations that you've included in the book and how graphic and emotional they are, I was thinking about how these were in homes with multi-generations and obviously children in them, and how today when the media presents difficult images, parents don't seem to know how to explain them to children or if children should be allowed to see them. Did you have any sense of how these were presented to children?
In some of the almanacs, there are whole pages that are addressed specifically to children. And we'll talk about, you know, what happens to enslaved children to really try to elicit, you know, children's identification and response, or how would you feel if you were sold away from your parents? So there was a direct appeal to children. There was no sense of protecting them. And the anti-slavery movement had periodicals, for example, The Slave's Friend, which was addressed specifically and made specifically for children. So they really understood children as the generation that was most important to reach, that it was children who would, in some sense, convert their parents, not vice versa.
And in addition to the almanac, the Anti-Slavery Society also had other publications, notably the slave narratives. But the slave narratives that you discuss in the book are perhaps not the ones that listeners are familiar with, or what they would have read during their own educational pursuits. These were very specifically crafted narratives meant to do specific tasks for the Anti-Slavery Society in support of sort of the dominant message that they were trying to create. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the reasons that I wrote this book was to decenter Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is kind of the placeholder for anti-slavery media when we talk about it in the 19th century, as if we know Uncle Tom's Cabin, we know anti-slavery media. And I'm really trying in the book to sort of show that Uncle Tom's Cabin was the apex of anti-slavery media, not its, you know, kind of original form, that it was really the 20 years leading up to Uncle Tom's Cabin that allowed Uncle Tom's Cabin to be the kind of breakthrough form that it was. Similarly, for the slave narrative, we read Frederick Douglass's narrative or Harriet Jacobs' narrative, And they stand in for a much larger, more complex, and broader genre. I think in the documenting the American South, North American slave narrative database, which is free to everybody online and which contains all the slave narratives published during the antebellum period. There are 80 slave narratives, and yet we only read one or two. So my hope is that in talking about how the slave narrative came to be through this institutional context of the anti-slavery movement, that it will encourage people to read more broadly in this genre. But the slave narrative that I talk about specifically, the narrative of James Williams, hasn't even really even made it into the genre. It was basically discredited in the 1830s. And because of that, many scholars just discredited it as well. It's only very recently that it's been accepted that it is actually a slave narrative and not a fictionalized text. So going back to this kind of lost origin story of the slave narrative with the narrative of James Williams, I talk about what the slave narrative can provide for the anti-slavery movement. So if you think about the almanac, even with its more graphic emotional images as providing a lot of data and facts, one of the ways in which the anti-slavery movement, besides images, wanted to reach the heart was through kind of personal storytelling, eyewitness accounts of the enslaved person. The only problem with that is that the enslaved person in the 19th century was always considered an unreliable narrator, as typified by Southern slaveholders who always said slaves were liars, etc. So bringing this kind of individual eyewitness personal account into the argument had both its pros in that it was able to kind of activate the argument through this kind of personal point of view, but also had its negatives in that it could be easily discredited since the enslaved narrator didn't have high cultural standing. So trying to negotiate that problem through the publication of this one slave narrative, the narrative of James Williams, is what I talk about in that section of the book.
And that led to them coming up with a different solution. They felt they didn't have enough hard data to deal with the accusations that were made against Mr. Williams' memoir. So they had to sort of leave it and go in a different direction. And as you said, that sort of left it to be buried by scholars and historians who are looking for slave narratives. So it's wonderful that you've put it in the book and documented for everyone how to find it and to begin to work with it and put it back where it belongs. Their solution at the time, though, when they were pivoting, was to come up with a new book. And that book was called Slavery As It Is. Can you tell listeners about the creation of this new publication that they were going to disseminate and its content and its purpose?
Sure. So when they produced the narrative of James Williams, which was the first slave narrative the American Anti-Slavery Society kind of, put their weight behind and said, kind of put their stamp on. They were kind of all in on that slave narrative. They were circulating it far and wide. It reached Europe. It reached Congress. It was hawked on the streets of New York. But then immediately, within just a few months of it coming out, there were Southern detractors saying, it's got places and people wrong and basically undermining the credibility of the text. So rather than defend James Williams, which is itself a pseudonym, they decided just to withdraw the text altogether. But in doing that, they were so kind of worried that this slave narrative had in some sense undercut their larger argument. They decided to counter this with a kind of ironclad fact-checked text, which we know now as Slavery As It Is, which some have called the Bible or the encyclopedia of the anti-slavery movement. It was the bestseller before Uncle Tom's Cabin, and Stowe even says she slept with it under her pillow when she was writing Uncle Tom's Cabin, or she had it in her work basket. Anyway, she references the fact that you know, it was the touchstone text for Uncle Tom's Cabin. And this text is almost unreadable. It's just lists and lists of facts in microscopic print, as if to chalk as much proof into one text as humanly possible in order to count this problem of James Williams. And the key evidence that's used in that text are excerpts from runaway slave holders, from runaway slaves. So, enslavers would put in, you know, Southern newspapers advertisements for their runaways, which described scars or other identification marks that could help find the slave. And these runaway slave ads are really just full of all the cruelties and brutalities that slavery produced. But because they are written from the slaveholder's point of view, they can't really be undermined by the slaveholder himself. So they were a kind of ironclad piece of evidence. And so Theodore Weld, along with his wife and sister-in-law, Sarah and Angelina Grimke, went through thousands and thousands and thousands of Southern newspapers to cull all of these examples of slavery's brutality, and then just kind of give it to you one after another after another. And it then became this argument about how cruel and horrible slavery is. And it was so airtight that it couldn't really be challenged. And that is the text that was produced to counter the problem of James Williams.
And beyond creating print texts and these coin collection boxes, they moved into having these anti-slavery fairs. And this is crucial to part of your thesis, which is that they were selling anti-slavery. And these markets were held at Christmas time. They were put on by female auxiliaries, and they were literally selling anti-slavery objects. You could get a pincushion or a sugar bowl with an image of a slave in shackles, and you could take it home. And you could gift them for a holiday gift for Christmas or New Year's to your friends and family. Were these objects that you were able to hold and see when you were in the archives?
Some of them were. At Swarthmore, they had the pincushion and the sugar bowl. But most of them were only really available to me through the copious reports of these fairs, where they would list all the items that they sold. While most of what I'm writing about in the book is popular media and hence more ephemeral in nature, the material objects, I would say, were the most ephemeral and difficult to kind of come across, not things that people saved per se, you know, a kind of hand-woven pot holder that says any holder but a slave holder. And a lot of the objects they just wouldn't have lasted this time long, or nobody would have thought to save them, I guess, you know, because they were kind of domestic material objects. They had a kind of lower status, as it were. But the women who organized these fairs, who manned these fairs, who basically created this, probably the longest organization. When I think about the American Anti-Slavery Society, it split into warring factions in 1840, but the fairs really ran from the beginning in the 1830s all the way to the end in the 1860s without a break. So that organizational structure was really crucial to not only the selling part, which I'll talk about in a minute, but also to the fundraising part. It was women's work and the money raised by these fairs that really bankrolled the movement from start to finish. So when these objects were, you would have at the fairs everything from these kind of handmade objects to much more luxurious objects that were imported from Europe. So drawing on the kind of transatlantic female connections. Women from Great Britain, especially, would send boxes of luxury or foreign objects over to Boston ahead of, say, for example, the Boston Fair. So some objects you couldn't otherwise get in the States, you could get at the anti-slavery fair. So the fair both allowed the anti-slavery message to be propagated through, again, these everyday domestic material objects, as well as for that message to get kind of connected to and attached to the kind of higher class, fashionable and foreign objects that made the Boston Fair in particular a kind of elite market space.
And you talk about how some of the objects were about sentimental consumerism, and some of them were clearly about what you call refinement. And one of the objects that is in the refinement category were these special gift books that were sold at the anti-slavery fairs. Can you tell listeners about the gift book and why someone would want to purchase it and how it was an emblem of refinement?
Sure. So the big urban fairs in Boston and Philadelphia, they produced gift books for the fairs, well, really the Boston Fair. And the gift book was meant to be a kind of souvenir of the fair. So almost in this small package, you would bring all the kind of cultural messages of the fair home with you. And the gift book was an important genre in the 19th century. It was a obviously a gift that was given at Christmas and New Year's, so a sign of kind of friendship and a way of community building, as it were. But also, it was also a place, at least in the fair's edition, of high art, literature as a kind of sign of taste. Again, the anti-slavery women were able to get literary donations from, you know, very prominent anti-slavery writers from England, Paris, et cetera. So again, high art coming into the gift book. And then the gift books themselves were beautiful art objects, often bound in fine leather or stamped, or again, having some sort of image of the Liberty Bell gift book, which was produced for the Boston Fair, had a picture of the Liberty Bell, and other sorts of engravings within the book. So it was a way for the anti-slavery movement to package itself as a kind of refined movement, and to say to be anti-slavery is to be, refined. Those two messages got connected together through the gift book. And also, you then brought it back home and it sat again on your parlor table, much like the box, and was the sign, you know, to your friends and family that you were converted to anti-slavery. And so there's a way in which anti-slavery became a marker of middle classness, of refinement, of gentility, that again, allowed it to go more mainstream in that way.
And the fairs you could pay to get into. But then they developed these salons, which were these social events that you say had social capital attached to them, because you had to have an invitation and you had to bring the invitation to the door to get in. Can you talk about the development of these salons and the social capital from them and how that further created this idea of this proper white northern middle class?
Sure. So I think of the fairs as both being markets where kind of commercial capital was produced, and also as a parlor, you know, kind of larger version of the parlor, what in the 19th century was known as kind of an exhibition. But also then its third instantiation was as a salon, which Maria Weston Chapman, who organized the fairs in Boston, she had gone to spend some time in Paris. And so when she came back, she was kind of tired. It had been many, you know, decades now of organizing these fairs every year. And so decided she wanted to model it on the Parisian salon. So again, bringing the foreign and the fashionable into the anti-slavery movement as a kind of class marker. And getting rid of the objects, which needed a kind of crass marketplace, and instead really leaning into the other part that the fairs did, which was kind of a place of sociability, a place you would go to meet and greet. Fairs often had, lectures, they had concerts, teas, soirees associated with it. By the time you get to the salon, that's all it is. It's just the social aspect. And instead of it being open to all, it's by invitation only. You would present your invitation, and instead of buying things and giving money directly through objects, you would politely put your donation in a letter, again, encased in sentiment, and give that to the managers of the fair. And then you would attend the tea table of the person that invited you to the fair. So it was all very genteel, very leaning into kind of aristocratic, mannered society. And again, re-inscribing what the gift books did kind of in a even more heightened way, that to be anti-slavery was to be of the very best society, of a kind of white middle-class gentility, that both because of anti-slavery's moral standing, but also that it had a particular social standing, which is pretty amazing if you think of how far the anti-slavery movement went from, you know, the 1830s, where people were, you know, Garrison was being tarred and feathered in the streets. And, you know, it was a kind of outsider status you had as anti-slavery, too. By the time the salons were happening, late 1850s, that suddenly anti-slavery was the kind of emblem of the most mannered society. That's a pretty incredible transition if you step back to look at it.
And it is an amazing transition, and their ability to get so much literature to so many people to educate them was really remarkable. But as you say, when slavery ended, the society had to decide what to do because they were an anti-slavery society. And you talk about how their legacy is complex. That on the one hand, the society offers a model for how media can create change. But on the other hand, the American Anti-Slavery Society's media forums became a vessel for other less equal agenda. And that less equal agenda really came to the forefront when they had to decide what, if anything, they were going to be after emancipation. Can you talk a bit about those things that you bring to the forefront in the conclusion?
Sure. I think over the course of studying all of their media, I mean, the anti-slavery movement was a very complex movement. It had working class people in it, middle class people in it. It had Black people in it. It had white people in it. So I'm really looking at it from the institutional point of view. And from the media, you know, what the messages the media is producing. And the messages that come out of the media are very much about white selfhood. It's really about the media is really speaking to a white audience, the institutional media I'm speaking here of, and also helping to form a kind of white national as well as white middle class identity. And to do that, they used the body of the enslaved person. And often it was subjugating that body in service of this larger agenda of kind of white production. And it's that inequality that I'm not doubting that they weren't trying to produce Black emancipation, but that was their focus. And while, again, media is complex, the movement's complex, and not all messages fall in line with this, the general message that's coming from the media is about freeing the enslaved person, but not about Black equality. And at the end, they're kind of infighting about should they continue, should they not. kind came down to maybe our job is done because now we have Black emancipation. And then others like Frederick Douglass arguing, hey, this is just the beginning of what needs to happen. Now we need to fight for Black equality, Black citizenship. That kind of infighting gets at some of the questions about what the larger goals of the movement and the media were.
And so how did they leave it when it gets to 1870? What did they decide to do?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't do a lot of studying of what happened to anti-slavery media in the, you know, in the 1860s and beyond. I was focused mostly on the 1830s and how it started and how it got produced at its beginnings. But it pretty much petered out. The fairs petered out. They didn't have money. The organizational structures, you know, kind of had dissolved by that time as well. And they seemed more focused on trying to consolidate their legacy in some sense, you know, putting together archives, making sure that there were, X number of copies of texts that they had that were, you know, put in libraries. It felt more like they were trying to properly shut down the shop, as it were, rather than kind of open up a second propaganda campaign that would try to convince the nation that now that Black people were free, that they had to be fully enfranchised. And yeah, there was a war and, you know, there were freedom schools and many other political projects that they were doing. The media focus wasn't really there per se.
That's a wonderful place to wrap up this book. We could talk about it for another hour because there's so much we haven't even touched on yet, but listeners will find the book and read more about how the American Anti-Slavery Society was selling anti-slavery. In the last few minutes we have left, will you tell us about what you're working on now?
Sure. And this is going to sound like a huge leap, but I am working on contemporary climate fiction. And you say, how do you get from the anti-slavery movement to contemporary climate fiction? And I guess I would come back to that original question I was asking in this book, which is how do you create social change through culture? And when I was finishing this book, I was thinking about, you know, the kind of social movements that we need now. And climate change seems a crucial one, and how we need a culture change in order to really deal with climate change. Or that's how I frame it when I talk to my undergraduates about this in my climate fiction class. And actually, as I was finishing the book, there was a large kind of discourse starting to emerge about the climate movement invoking the anti-slavery movement as a model for itself. So I've just finished up a piece talking about that connection of why the climate movement is invoking the anti-slavery movement as a model, and why that may be useful or may not be useful, especially given the kind of vexed racial legacy that I just talked about that the anti-slavery movement left us with. So that's one piece. And then the second piece I'm working on is around this idea of the plantationocene, which is this notion that slavery's global expropriation of land and labor, people and plants, was really the watershed moment in climate history. So taking this notion of the Anthropocene and really trying to place it in history with this notion of it really occurring at the moment of plantation slavery. And I'm looking at how the slave narrative and then the contemporary neo-slave narrative records this long history of the plantationocene, as well as kind of encodes alternative ecologies of resistance and repair that might be models for us as we move into this moment of climate crisis. So it's a big leap, but I think it has actual connections.
I think so too. I can see a through line. I hope when it's done, you'll send it to me so I can have you back. Teresa Gaudu, thank you so much for being on the show today and telling us not just about selling anti-slavery, but about the process of writing it, the research you did in the archives, how you managed your work-life balance as a mother and a scholar and a professor. It's been a really fascinating conversation. We've been talking about selling anti-slavery, abolition, and mass media in antebellum America. You're listening to New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler. Please join us again.